But I started thinking back to the early days when I was associated with Truett, when we were still over at First Baptist, and I couldn't help but remember the days where I would be teaching class and Ruth Ann Foster would be leaving for the day, and she decided to hang out by the back window of the door to my classroom and act like she was going up and down on the elevator and try to get my attention as I was lecturing. I remember the community there, and as we have built it over the years and what I have seen Truett become, and it is exciting to me today to be here and reflect back not only on our history as Truett, but the history that people who have gone before us have, who made this place possible. Most of you, in fact, I doubt any of you would know the name Gerald Griffin. He was my pastor growing up. You wouldn't know what he was like, really, what he preached like, and yet you would because you see me. Gerald Griffin had an impact on who I was. He made a difference in the type of communicator I am today by being a mentor to me. Some of you, most of you, probably aren't familiar with the name B.H. Carroll. Those of you that are Baylor graduates may have walked by the portrait in the Tidwell Bible Building of the guy who looks like one of the guitarists for ZZ Top. That would be B.H. Carroll. B.H. Carroll was a mentor to George W. Truett. In fact, the passage of scripture that we heard this morning was part and a portion of the passage that Truett chose to read at Carroll's funeral when he preached it. As he began to speak at the funeral, Truett said, "Some other day, on some other occasion, I may speak out of my heart something of my personal feelings for him. But I dare not, cannot, will not do so today." This man, Carroll, had a significant impact on the man this school is named after. All of us can point towards people who has helped shape our lives to this point and our ministry. All of us need to realize that there will be people along the way in our ministry that we will also help influence and shape. This morning, I'd like to spend a little bit of time introducing you to B.H. Carroll, who in many respects was the pastor to the preacher, George W. Truett. Carroll was born in 1843 in Mississippi. Now, he did get to Texas quickly, so that's good news for those of us who are Texans. But when he was born in Mississippi, he was born the seventh of 12 children. His parents had 12 other children that they were raising. Yeah, you do the math, that's a really big family. His dad was a bivocational minister and farmer. I'm pretty sure he really didn't have to do anything but preach to his family to have a congregation. But he took his ministry very seriously, always looking for a place to preach, no matter where he was, whether it be in Mississippi where the family started, or it be in Arkansas where they moved, or finally when they ended up in Texas. Now, B.H.'s father had no formal training, but he did have a commitment to share the gospel. And early on in Carroll's life, he saw the importance and knew the importance of words. You see, when he was a small boy, there were some other boys running around, and there was a house that they considered haunted. And so all the boys got together whatever they had, you know, a top, some string, marbles, Nintendo, no, it wasn't that early. And they said, okay, whichever one of us goes inside that house and comes back out, they're going to get all this stuff. Well, Carroll volunteers. So he goes inside the house, he stays a little while, and he comes back out, and he looks at his friends, and he said, and they said, what'd you see? And Carroll reported, said, "The thing I saw was better than God and worse than the devil. Dead men live on it, but if live men eat it, they will die." Well, you know, two things happened right there. One, his friends had no idea what he was talking about. And two, that guaranteed that no one else would go in that house. Naturally, he got all of the prizes that were set out. Throughout the rest of his ministry, he would use words oftentimes to influence crowds he spoke to. We know that it was one of his speeches before the SBC that likely saved the whole mission board. That he was so motivated and so inspired that by the time he was done, the messengers could do nothing else but verify the need for a home mission board. We know that his powerful speech before the trustees of Baylor University was so moving that they voted to create a seminary even when the president of the college was out of the country. Can you imagine being the president of Baylor University and getting back and finding out that the trustees voted to create a new school? But his speech was that powerful. Well, as he grew up, and being the son of a preacher, he was oftentimes around different things and different gatherings. One of the interesting customs that his family had while they gathered was they would drink whiskey every morning. It was supposedly good for the body. Well, apparently, a lot of the Carroll men took to it because they became hardened drinkers. In fact, J.M. Carroll, his brother, reports that B.H. was one of them, that they really had to fight the effects of alcohol later in life because of this, as J.M. called it, their strange family custom. Eventually, Carroll's father promised one of his sons a buggy and horse if he'd stop drinking. So much for the good health that drinking whiskey could do for the family. So we know that Carroll was exposed to really the dangers of drunkenness as a boy, which I think always is interesting how heavily involved he was in the prohibition movement when he was older, yet he never mentioned that he had any dealings with alcohol in any sermon he dealt with. Well, when he was at these different gatherings, he also went to a revival meeting, not one that his father was preaching, just a revival meeting. At the end of it, some men came up to him and asked him three questions. Basically, you know, do you believe in Jesus? Do you, all of these? And he answered affirmative to every one of them. So they led him to the front of the church and said, this boy's ready to join. 13 years old, he answered the questions right, joined the church. Back then, the custom in the Baptist church was that you would give testimony immediately upon joining the church to prove that you had had some type of experience. But the hour was late, and so they elected not to do it. So they just welcomed Carroll into the church, and he was baptized. Well, going home, he realized, I wasn't converted. I didn't have any kind of experience. And so he asked for his name to be withdrawn from the roll of the church. And the church said, oh, you're just having second thoughts. You'll get over it. It'll be okay. We know that Carroll himself said from this, he really turned away from the church because they were so unresponsive to his situation. Now, he'd go on, went to college. His teacher in public school before said he couldn't teach him anymore, so he sent him to Baylor at the age of 16. And when he was at Baylor, he'd already become known as a great debater. In fact, in Caldwell, Texas, where he grew up, he once debated both sides of the doctrines of Alexander Campbell, and the group who heard him affirmed both his arguments. When he got to Baylor, he developed a friendship with R.C. Burleson, who was president of Baylor at the time and the pastor of Independence Baptist Church. Now, Carroll didn't get involved in church, but he did develop this friendship with Burleson. And as the Civil War was coming up and getting closer, Carroll and his family were devout unionists. In fact, he would often speak about the importance of the Union as a student at Baylor. But of course, eventually, there's no way you can put off what was going to happen. And when Texas leaves the Union, Carroll leaves Baylor. Now, instead of joining the Confederate Army, which he really didn't believe in at the time, he joins the Texas Rangers and heads to the western frontier. And while he's on the frontier, his father has a horse accident and is really fatally wounded. He's not going to live very long. Carroll comes back to Caldwell. While he is there, spending the last days with his father, he also meets a woman, Ophelia Crunk. And they get married soon after the death of his father. It's time for him to go back to the frontier. He says, Ophelia, let's go. She says, I don't think so. I don't want to go to the frontier. So he goes ahead and goes, and all the time trying to work to get her to come to the frontier with him. Eventually he comes back and he says, come on, we need to be a family. You need to go with me. And she says no, and the only reason she can give him is she does not love him. Ouch. He decides then he's going to join the Confederate Army. His life is lost. His brother, J.M., will actually be in his place and sue for divorce from Ophelia on the grounds of adultery. And the judge who hears the case, R.E.B. Baylor, will find for Carol, and Ophelia Crunk will have to pay the court costs. So Carol is now young, divorced, lost, doesn't see a reason to live. And he's still a little irritated at the church that wouldn't take him off the roll. He goes, joins the Confederate force, volunteers for almost any dangerous duty he can. And during that time, too, preachers would come to camp. Those of you who are students of the Civil War know that a lot of the preachers that worked in Confederate camps weren't very good. And when the preacher would come to town, he'd get up on one stump and Carol would get on a stump down the way and preach against whatever the preacher was preaching, and he'd attract larger crowds. Think about it. This is a time of war, and these guys are entertained by Carol on the stump so they don't go listen to the preacher. Eventually, Carol gets wounded at the Battle of Mansfield, Louisiana, almost dies from a leg injury, and he goes home. And on crutches one day, he goes at the behest of his mother to a revival meeting. And while he is there, the preacher stands up at the invitation. And he looks out at the crowd and he says, you that stand aloof from Christianity and scorn us simple folks, what have you got? If there be a God, mustn't there be something else? If so, how do you know it is not here? Are you willing to test it? I don't ask you to read any book, nor study any evidences, nor make any pilgrimages. Are you willing to try it now, to make a practical experimental test, you to be the judge of the results? Carol will later say he is so moved by the invitation that he just found himself at the front of the meeting. And one of the people come up to him and says, do you have a decision to make? And it's almost like Carol snaps out of it, and he was too proud to admit that he felt convicted. So he says, no, I have no decision to make. And he goes home that night, and he tells his mother what has happened. And his mother says, well, son, I think that you've finally been converted. He says that she gave him a copy of Pilgrim's Progress to read that night. And he read it and wept. And the next morning had no doubt about his salvation. Now for Carol, getting this problem solved, now that it was almost instantaneous that he felt like he was called to be a preacher. He's quickly ordained by his church in Caldwell, becomes a bivocational preacher. In fact, for a while in 1869, he served as the pastor of the New Hope Baptist Church just outside Waco. And if you're wondering where that is today, the Westwood Baptist Church in Woodway, or Hewitt, is the descendant of that New Hope Church. And while he is there, R.C. Burleson, who had left Baylor and come to Waco University in 1861, was also serving as pastor of First Baptist Waco in 1870. And he said, you know, B.H., why don't you come on over? It's Harvey, as his friends called him. Why don't you come over and assist me at First Waco? So he did. And very soon, he was pastoring the First Baptist Church of Waco, Texas. And he was an innovator. When he was pastor of that church, he wrote articles dealing with why it was all right for churches to use instruments in the worship service. How the choir was a good thing. Only they were only supposed to help sing. They couldn't sing by themselves. But at the time, in the 1870s, for Texas, That was innovative. The fact that women could serve as deaconesses, another innovation that most churches would not even broach the subject. And Carroll addressed why he was pastor of First Waco. In 1874, what would become a seminary started when he started teaching William Buck Bagby in his study at First Baptist Church, Waco. I've always thought that it was so appropriate that our seminary started in the halls of First Baptist Waco, mirroring what Carroll had done so many years before with his seminary education. Now, I should tell you, Carroll didn't lose his old ways. You know, he had been in the army. He was a fighter. During his ministry, he was involved in almost every controversy that Southern Baptists had. And when his personal pride was challenged, he took it head on. Perhaps no better example of this is than when he was riding with his brother on a streetcar in Waco. As they're walking up to the streetcar, B.H. is talking to J.M. And he turns to J.M. and he says, you know, I don't know where my son gets his fighting proclivities. It seems like his son had some problems in school. So as they're getting on the streetcar, B.H. pushed his ticket down. J.M. puts his right behind and is apparently covering B.H.'s ticket. The streetcar driver looks back and tells B.H., you need to pay. B.H. said, I did. You just don't see my ticket. An argument ensues. Finally, the streetcar driver just says, fine, go sit down. Now remember, this is the pastor of First Baptist Church, Waco, 6'4", 250 pounds. So he puts his foot in the door to the driving compartment of the streetcar because he wants to continue the discussion with the streetcar driver. The streetcar driver is getting a little intimidated now. In fact, he probably feared for his life because we know he jumped over the dashboard of the streetcar, flagged another streetcar down, and tried to switch places. Carroll runs out of the streetcar, grabs him by the shirt, and says, I will not let you go until you admit I paid. Finally, the streetcar driver says, you did. You paid. Carroll gets back on the streetcar. J.M. says, as B.H. sat down, there was this moment of awkward silence. And finally, B.H. looks at him and says, perhaps I do know where he gets his fighting proclivities. He was always a fighter. But he worked hard for what he believed in. Eventually, as he's trying to raise money for education here in Texas, and particularly theological education, he knows that the debt that Baylor University has needs to be addressed. And in 1890, he's trying to go around the state and raise money, but he needs help. And as he's trying to raise money, a man tells him, look, there is a young preacher in White Right, Texas, named George W. Truett. You should go and talk to him and see if he can help you. And Carroll asks him, well, what's the deal with this young preacher? And the man says, there is one thing I do know about George W. Truett. Wherever he speaks, the people do what he asks. So Carroll goes, and he meets with Truett. They form almost an immediate bond. In fact, P.W. James, Truett's biographer and grandson, notes that when the two came together and when Truett accepted the assignment to be an agent for Baylor University, he moved in with B.H. Carroll and his family. And he says, for 6 years, George Truett had almost daily contact with his friend and teacher, Dr. B.H. Carroll. That in itself was a liberal education. He had free access to Carroll's private library, which was one of the very best in the South. Dr. Carroll never was happier than when talking to Truett far into the night on the great themes of religion, philosophy, and literature. He gave to George Truett hundreds of hours of Socratic fellowship. He sought to lay solid foundations in the minds and hearts of his protege for the great work in life which he felt the young man would do. Between Carroll and Truett, they really did eliminate that debt that Baylor. In fact, the very reason, or I should say the very fact that this school exists today, that Truett is a part of, is largely the work of those two men in the early 90s, raising money among Baptist folk to save Baylor University. Eventually, Truett will graduate from Baylor, and, and he will receive a call from the First Baptist Church of Dallas. The friendship, though, between Carroll and Truett continued to grow. They served on boards together with the BGCT. They were active with each other. In fact, when S.A. Hayden in the Hayden controversy will sue Baptist leaders, he sues Carroll and Truett together. So they were together even in conflict. They were together. When Carroll resigned the First Baptist Church of Waco to spend more time in education, First Baptist wanted Truett to return from Dallas and pastor the church because they realized the bond between the two men, but Truett declined. Little is left of the correspondence between the two men. We do know, I have seen a letter that Truett wrote Carroll trying to get him to locate what would become Southwestern Seminary in Dallas, and Carroll telling him that he did not think that would be an appropriate place for the seminary, largely because Buckner Orphan's Home was there, and he didn't want to have two big Baptist groups or two big Baptist institutions in the same location. But I think one of the most interesting letters that does exist between the two is a letter that Truett wrote Carroll in 1911, 3 years before Carroll's going to die, and after Truett had really established himself as a leader among Baptists. Listen to this letter. Truett writes, "I desire your faithful counsel concerning an address I am to make in connection with the Baptist World Alliance to be held June next in Philadelphia." Later on in the letter, he says, "The object, therefore, of this letter is to ask your best counsel on what I should say. Advise me freely and fully, for which I shall be profoundly grateful. Get the occasion before you. See the Baptists from all over the world, even from all the lands where it yet means the most awful persecution to be Baptist. Remember the diversity of opinions among Baptists gathered there." Almost a priceless line, even good today. "Call to mind our progress and perils, our trials and opportunities, what our future should be and why." And then he ends it by saying, "I will be greatly comforted by the thought that you, underlined, will approve what I am going to say." Wow. This man, B.H. Carroll, never finished his college education, who dealt with what was on the verge, apparently from his brother, of alcoholism, who had experienced the pains of divorce, who had turned his back on the church as a young age before having an emotional conversion experience, surrendered to the ministry, found this young man, George Truett, put him to work, and Truett became his protege. And even as Truett was in the ministry and had established himself as a leader, he would be profoundly grateful for the help of B.H. Carroll. Carroll's influence was that great. You know, Carroll was far from perfect, but God used him. You and I need to realize that we are far from perfect. And we need to stop using that as an excuse and realize that God will use us. We need to realize the responsibility that comes along with being part of the ministry, that just as Carroll influenced Truett, we will influence others. We will make an impact, whether positive or negative, on those around us. Much like Carroll helped shape Truett, our presence here is helping shape this Truett. What this place is and will become is determined by the people who come through our doors. Students and faculty who are here 50 years from now may not know who we were, but we can help determine who they become by the type of community we form together and build for the future. Thank you.